Tonight we're going to begin looking at the book of Judges, and in particular, Judges chapter 1 and chapter 2. And let's consider a little about this book. Sometimes this book is neglected. It has lots of stories that involve brutal actions. Some of the episodes are actually quite disgusting. And some people think, well, I'd just rather read the New Testament. But you know, there's a great need for this book today, because we also live in a day where people do what is right in their own eyes instead of what God told them to do. Now, you can raise some questions about this period of history. What was God's goal for this period? Why did God allow such offensive sin to develop and continue among his people for a long time? What's the purpose of all this? I believe that the reason God had a period like this of about 340 years was to give his people the opportunity for the greatest blessing and to give the greatest advertisement for God. You see, God had determined that his people would be governed not by a democracy, that's where the people rule, not by a monarchy, that's where the earthly king rules, but by a theocracy, that means God is ruling. And so the purpose of God during this period was to rule over his people as king, and there would be no visible ruler, no court, no bureaucracy, no Congress, and God would be the center of the people's attention. And so, you notice, before Moses died, he was very careful to choose a successor named Joshua. But Joshua did not choose a successor. And there are people who would say, well, Joshua made a mistake. He should have. That's not true. Joshua was right in not choosing a successor. Joshua is the Old Testament name for Jesus. And Jesus is the one that can lead you into the promised land, not Moses, the law, but Jesus, and Jesus has no successor. It was God's full intention that Joshua lead them into the promised land, and then that there be no earthly king. God is to be king. But God had given them the law. You know, sometimes people say, well, there's the secular law, and then there's the religious law. Or they might say, there's the ceremonial law, and the civil law, and the moral law. And they divide the law into those three categories. You know, the scripture never divides the law like that. And besides, if you try to divide the law like that, you have tremendous problems. For example, according to the law, a brother was to marry his deceased brother's wife. Is that civil, ceremonial, or moral? You can see that it would be all three. Or what about if you disobey the Sabbath year law? You know, the Sabbath year, you're supposed to cancel debts. What if you say, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not canceling your debt. Would that be a moral violation, or a civil violation, or a ceremonial violation? Actually, it would be all three again. You see, God's laws are to permeate every area of these people's lives. Now, if you're milking cows, you better milk cows to the glory of God. And if you can't do that, you better get out of the cow business. If you're driving truck, you better do it to the glory of God. If you can't drive truck to the glory of God, you better get out of that business. We're supposed to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind. And then we'll be able to teach our children. So this law was given at Mount Sinai before they entered into Canaan. There was no need for more lawgivers to make more laws. You know, we have Congress making laws so fast, it would keep a person busy just reading the new laws that are made. And then they have a priesthood. This was the only earthly representative, and it wouldn't detract from this idea of God being king, but actually enhance it, because the priesthood is to be pointing people continually to God, helping them understand God and his ways. Now, when you have a government where God, the invisible one, is king, that's called a theocracy. A theocracy can only work when there's a proper response from the people. You see, God hadn't created some kind of elaborate enforcement machinery to control sin, because that would involve civil government and contradict the very principle of theocracy. God wanted voluntary obedience from his people, just like God wants voluntary obedience from his people today. But the result is, unless there's that positive response from the people, in a theocracy, disobedience becomes more pronounced and more serious. And you can see this when you read the latter part of the book of Judges, which incidentally, when you look at the chronology, actually occurred near the beginning of the period. And it's so bad with their continual spiral downhill, you can figure that it got worse than what you have pictured there at the end. And so what did God do when his people behaved wickedly and weren't really obeying him as king? God, in his wonderful mercy, actually brought punishment through a series of foreign oppressions, foreign enemies conquering them. He did not just automatically destroy his people. Now, why did God bring in foreigners to oppress his people? Well, God wanted to give his best form of government ample time to work. You see, it would be a greater benefit to the people to have God as king. That's much better than having an earthly king. And besides, it would be a greater honor to God. You remember, the land of Israel is at the center of the nations. If you want to go from Africa to Europe, you go through Israel. If you want to go from Africa to Mesopotamia, you go through Israel. You see, there's that interconnection. Now, as God's people are situated there, and if they obey him, God will pour out his blessings on them, and the foreigners coming through are going to say, "My, this is a prosperous country. What is the cause of this?" And so, when his people did not behave themselves and be obedient, God, in his wonderful mercy and grace, brought in foreign oppressors so that it would be like, "Wake up! Repent! Something's wrong here." And then God would raise up a deliverer, and they could marvel at God's mercy and his salvation. And then at the death of this judge, boom, it reverted back to a pure theocracy again. God gave him another chance. Have me as king. Now, have you ever noticed the chaos in churches? Just trouble. What is that saying? It is shouting. Something is wrong here. The chaos in churches is a gigantic blessing from God. Do you believe that? Some of you aren't sure. If there's something fundamentally wrong, and God allows chaos to be in the churches, isn't that a blessing from God? That's shouting, something is wrong here, you better deal with it. Well, you see, that's what was happening in the time of the judges. God brought in oppressors. And that shouted, something is wrong here. And the people, "Oh, Lord, help us. Lord, we need help." And so they cry out to God. And God, in his mercy, would raise up a deliverer. And then that deliverer would teach them about God. They would follow God for a while. And then when that deliverer died, it wasn't that his son would become king. It reverted back to a pure theocracy again. However, after hundreds of years of failure, God finally gave them second best, and that was to have an earthly king. Now, think about this. Here's some foreigners come through the land, and let's say at the first part they're obeying God, and so they're prospering, and they look around and they say, "Look at this land. It is so prosperous. It is so wonderful. The people are getting along with each other. There's no oppression. How can this be? Oh, take me to your king. He will tell me how this works. He will show me what's going on." And you say, "Well, we have a king, but he's invisible." "What do you mean he's invisible?" "Well, the king we have is the God who created heaven and earth, not only this land right here in the middle of the nations, but all the nations." And God This God, who's ruler over all heaven and earth, is our king, and he gave us a set of laws that we're to obey, and so we follow his laws, and that produces all this prosperity. Would you like a copy of that law that he gave to us? We'll give you a copy. In fact, we will send a Levite along with you so you can go back to your home country and learn about all of this. Wouldn't that have been wonderful? But what happened? And just think of it. No king, no earthly king, no Congress, no bureaucrats sitting in plush offices taxing you for nothing. No cheating on the administration, all this kind of stuff. What a wonderful deal. And what did the Israelites say? Give us a king. Anyone remember why they wanted a king? That he may go before us and fight our battles like the nations. Now, why did they want that? Well, the Israelites had learned that if they didn't behave themselves, God would send in foreign oppressors, and in a battle they would lose. That wasn't too nice, was it, for them? But they noticed that other nations had kings, and so they could command the army and tell the ambush to go this way and the main army to go this way, and they could win their battles. Well, that's what we want. You see, wasn't God able to fight battles? He had demonstrated it many a time. For example, you remember when the chariots were coming after the Israelites, and God opened up the Red Sea in front of the Israelites, and they're going through, and the chariots are getting too close. What happened next? God put a dark cloud between them so that the Israelites had light and the Egyptians had darkness. Well, that would slow you down a little bit. And they're still getting too close, so God took their chariot wheels off. And says, I love how it says it, they drove with difficulty. Now, did you notice when you read that, it didn't say, those stupid mechanics back in Egypt, they didn't grease the bearings. No wonder the wheels fell off. They didn't say that at all. They said, the Israel's God is fighting against us. Oh, man, that's powerful. And you can go through their history and you can find where God fought battles for them. Well, he was a great warrior. Why didn't they like their king in heaven to be their king? Because if they didn't obey him, God let the enemies come in and smash them. In other words, we want to live like we want to live. And when we do that, God doesn't help us. So we want to set up a king of our own so we can win our battles even if we don't obey God. Now, let me ask you something. Does that sound familiar? You think that happens in churches? We want to live like we want to live without obeying God as king, and then we'll fix a mechanism somehow to make our life successful apart from God. Do you see why the book of Judges is so relevant to us? Because Jesus is our king, and he wants our voluntary obedience. And the book of Judges is an object lesson to show us the absolute folly and stupidity of thinking that we can be successful apart from God by creating a system of our own. So, they said, we want a king. And God said to Samuel, warn them, tell them what it's going to be like. This king will take the best of your fields and give them to your friend, his friends. He'll take your daughters. He'll make them cooks. He'll take your sons and have them run before his chariots. He'll do this, he'll do that, he'll do something else. And you'll be crying out in the oppression in that day, and I will not hear you. Now you would think they would have said, well, wait a minute, we changed our mind. They said, we don't care, we want a king anyway. You see, we can do what we want, we'll make it work. So they got a king. Now, let's suppose that God prospers the nation of Israel, and they have their king. And some foreigner comes through here, and he says, oh, you're so prosperous. How does this work? Take me to your king. So you take him to your king. And he just decides, oh, I see. They just have a king like us. They just have a few different rules than we have. That's their way of doing it. We have our way of doing it. You see, the testimony is lost. But anyway, during this period of the judges, before they got a king, the judges were not kings, they were emergency people. They had two purposes: to deliver from foreign oppression and to curtail or to stop sin. You see, it was the nearest thing to a pure theocracy, because they were emergency people, they got the people out from oppression, they taught people about God, then they died, and their son didn't become king, they didn't elect a new king, and now God is giving them a chance to have the best form of government again. What a merciful, wonderful God. So you see, he let the period of judges go on for hundreds of years so that his best form of government had ample time to work. You know, God still wants to be king today. Are we willing to have him as king, or would we rather devise something of our own? So, what is the purpose of this book? It warns against apostasy, against turning away from God. You see, when you look at chapter 1, you find that the people did something right at the very beginning. After the death of Joshua, the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" See, they didn't appoint an earthly king. They questioned God as their king. Who shall go first? And the Lord said, "Judah. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand." Now, Judah, notice, did not say, "Okay, I am going to march on the basis of what you told me." He immediately makes a deal with Simeon, his brother. You know, if you come up and help me, I'll go help you. Isn't that how like we are so many times? We are more concerned about rallying some people around us to go help do something, maybe God told us to do it, than we are in trusting God to do what he told us to do in the first place. But they had a measure of faith, and so they went up against the allotted territory. And the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand. They killed 10,000 men at Bezek. They found Adoni-Bezek and Bezek and fought against him. They defeated the Canaanites and Perizzites. And so they caught Adoni-Bezek and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Now, what's going on there? They are copying the pagan practice of mutilating a captured king. And so Adoni-Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has done, repaid me. So they brought him to Jerusalem. There he died. So you see, they did some things that are right, but they had spiritual deficiencies as they went along. In fact, you can see that not only did they copy this pagan practice, but they had sufficient faith and perseverance to drive out the mountaineers, verse 19, but not enough faith to drive out the plains dwellers because they had chariots. Now, what's going on there? See, they aren't really trusting in God completely. I mean, these fellows had chariots of iron. It says there in verse 19. Now, obviously, God has demonstrated he knows how to deal with chariots. But instead of trusting God, they just let those lowland people stay there. See, the issue is not whether they have chariots or not. It is whether you look in faith to God to fulfill what he has called us to do. You see, Judah, in a certain sense, had the mindset of the world. They had some faith, but did not fully follow God in faith. Then we come to Benjamin, verse 21. The children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. You see, they just simply decided not to do it. So, that was a deliberate choice of disobedience. Now, if you glance at Judges chapter 20 sometime, you find the Benjamites were fierce fighters. They were capable of victory over a vastly larger force. But you see, they chose simply not to obey God. It's just amazing how humanity does that. Verse 22 to 26, the house of Joseph. They destroyed Luz. And then there are other Canaanites that deliberately refused to destroy the Canaanites in their territory. Now, why did they refuse to? Well, just think about it. Maybe they saw some ladies over there in those other countries, those other kingdoms. They liked them pretty much. And besides, warfare, hand-to-hand combat is hard work. So why not just say, you know what, we're not going to drive them out. We're just going to keep them back there in the hills or in the valleys, wherever they are. They can work hard all year, and then we'll come take their stuff. We'll make them pay tribute to us. Wouldn't that be better and smarter than killing them all? Killing them is a lot of work, and there's some ladies over there we'd like. I think we'll just do it another way. It reminds me of what I heard when some people at a church were getting ready to choose a leader, and somebody said, but what you're doing here doesn't fit with what God says and how to choose a leader in the church. And they said, well, I know it doesn't, but I think God will bless this too. That really is not the way to do it. And so, what did they do? Verse 28, it says that it came to pass when Israel was strong, they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. Verse 30, or verse 29, nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer. So the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol. So the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. You see, we're going to do it a different way because we think there's an advantage. Basically, whenever we say we're not going to do it the way God says, we're saying our ideas are better than God's. Now that sounds awful. Do you know why that sounds awful? Because it is awful. Now the key here is chapter 1, verse 27 and 35, the Canaanites were determined to stay there. You see, if you aren't aggressive in dealing with the Canaanites in your life, they're going to stay. Now notice the progression in terms of the disobedience here of these tribes. Judah was the most faithful, but they failed to conquer those who had chariots of iron. They did not put the pagans under tribute. You know, tribute means where they had to pay a yearly fee. The Canaanites dwelt among them as a minority. For example, the Benjamites, the Jebusites, verse 21. Manasseh, they didn't drive out whole towns and villages of their territory. And it's the first tribe that is mentioned as not putting the Canaanites under tribute. Then Ephraim, verse 29. The Canaanites are dwelling among them, but still a minority. Zebulun, verse 30. But then Asher, in verse 31 and 32, and Naphtali, verse 33, they dwelt among the Canaanites. In other words, the Canaanites are the majority in their cases, and they are just the minority dwelling among them. And then you find in verse 34, they were forced into territorial restriction. The Amorites forced Dan into the mountains and would not allow them to come into the valley. So the Amorites are dominant there. They're not letting Dan do what he was supposed to do. Now, there was some relief when Joseph was strong, putting the enemy under tribute. But you see the tragic result of this? It is Joseph became strong, putting the enemy under tribute. So it's a tragic solution that tribal help rather than obedience to God is the solution. Oh, that sounds familiar too, doesn't it? Let's go over here and get some kind of help instead of obeying God and dealing with the root problem. Now remember, Joshua crushed the kingdoms. Jesus crushed the head of Satan. Okay? But it's our responsibility to take God's power and conquer the Canaanites in our life. You know, what are the things, the besetting sins? You don't just say, well, whenever God cures this problem, it's going to be great. I was talking to a man one time, and he tried to claim that there are only two commandments in the New Testament. The first one is, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second, love your neighbor as yourself. And I said, well, what about love your wife? He said, well, I'm sure that would be great. You know, when the Lord makes that happen, that'll be good. I guess his wife would have liked that probably if that ever happened. But you know, that's not our attitude. It's like God has given us something to do, and we need to act in faith and conquer whatever besetting sin we have. So, that brings us to chapter 2. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So it was, when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voices and wept. Then they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. And when Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. Now notice here in verses 1 to 5, the angel of the Lord came from Gilgal, that's the place where the covenant was renewed, Joshua 5:9, to Bochim, the weeping place. You see, the Israelite parents in the wilderness were so stubborn and so rebellious, they refused to circumcise their children in the wilderness. And Joshua rolled away that reproach by having a mass circumcision at Gilgal. Now look how Joshua is dealing with a long-standing 40-year-old problem that even the illustrious Moses didn't deal with. How would you like to become pastor of a church that for 40 years had been doing something wrong, and shortly after you get there, the Lord says, now listen, you deal with this problem that's been going on in this church for 40 years. That would give you a little idea of Joshua's position. And his doing what God said, that Gilgal place became a memorial place where the reproach was rolled away. You know, sin is always a reproach. And the repudiation of sin and the confession of that sin and the putting it away is a rolling away of that reproach. But notice that the angel of the Lord came from Gilgal to Bochim. Bochim is the place of weeping. And that shows the cost of carnality. It shows the cost of saying we're going to take our own way instead of the way of God the King. God says, I'm not going to drive out your enemies anymore. They're going to be like thorns in your eyes. You know, if you have a thorn in your eye, even if you have a speck of dirt in your eye, not only is it painful, it is also what? Blinding. It hurts so much you can hardly hold that eyelid open. Just imagine if a thorn is in your eye yet, how blinding that would be. You see, these false gods would be a snare to them. Now, what this means, of course, is that if we refuse to stay at Gilgal, that's the place where the flesh is cut, you will end up in Bochim, weeping. God will let you live in your sins. You see, God empowers the choice of immediate obedience. But to those who are dallying with, well, should I obey this? Well, I don't know. I think I'll just try to get rid of it gradually. You know what? They're left to wallow in that problem for a lifetime. I know a man who became a pastor, and he told me that he grew up in Harlem, New York. And he was on heroin. And one night, he got converted. He said, I had so much heroin in my system that I didn't sleep for 10 days. I went off of heroin cold turkey. And while he was doing that, he was reading his Bible and smoking cigarettes. You see what God did for him? He said yes to God, and God did an amazing thing. He gave him the ability to go off of heroin cold turkey. But he still drank liquor. And he thought, or beer. And he thought, you know, I'm going to get rid of that gradually. And he told me that he and his girlfriend could go from New York City through the Holland Tunnel out toward New Jersey. And sometimes you have traffic jams there, you can't go very fast. And they could polish off a six-pack, you know, in the time it took to go through the Holland Tunnel. It didn't work. You know what he had to do? He had to say, I'm not going to try to go off it gradually. Lord, I'm renouncing this. I have another friend who was in the Air Force. And he said, I was an alcoholic. And it was so bad that when I went to get discharged, I was afraid I'd get a dishonorable discharge because my hand was shaking so much. But anyway, he had a friend that kept bothering him about becoming a Christian. And this guy kept after him for so long He finally became a Christian. And he was still drinking. Well, not all the time. I mean, you know, he would quit. But then his problem was that, like, he'd go to a wedding. And he loved to witness. But at the wedding, alcoholic beverages were served. And so he'd drink a little bit. And when he drank a little bit, he'd drink a little more and a little more and a little more until he was really drunk. And one night he woke up in front of the commode and he said, it was just like as if God said to him, listen, if you don't put that away, you will never have a testimony from me. You know what he did? He said yes to God right there. And he said, I didn't have a problem with it after that. You see, if you dally with it, you can struggle with it for a long time. But if you say, yes, God, this is wrong, this is sin, I'm putting it away, he can give you the power to overcome. But here this nation, God had told them, you do this and this and this, this way. And they said, you know what? We have decided to do it a different way that we like better. God said, okay, if that's your decision, here's my decision. I'm not going to drive them out now. You can just bother with those pesky Canaanites the rest of your life. There'll be thorns in your side. Thorns in your eyes. They are going to be blinding to you. You're going to have lots of problems. But anyway, notice in verse 6, when Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work that he had done for Israel. Now, notice, they served the Lord, verse 7, all the days of Joshua. You know, they had seen what had happened to their parents in the wilderness. In fact, I think it's very interesting. Someone has pointed out those 40 years in the wilderness, for the parents, it was a scene of judgment. God said, okay, you don't want to go into the land? You can walk around in the desert till you fall over dead. Now imagine having that as a pronouncement. All you've got to do, you've got to stay in the desert, just keep walking around, not going anywhere in particular, but staying here a while, going to the next place. You're just walking around there until you fall over dead. And you notice the parents continued in their stubborn rebellion against God again and again and again. So it was a time of judgment for the parents. But what about the next generation? It was a time of education. They could see, we don't want to get like our fathers were. And so they were very careful to obey Joshua when they went into the land. But now what do you have happening? They served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, the ones who had seen all the mighty works of God. In other words, the mighty work which God had done, including the Egyptian plagues. You see, some of them would still have been alive because like the five-year-olds would have seen the Egyptian plagues. And then they would have outlived those rebellious parents that stayed in the desert. And then they would also see the conquest of Canaan. But when you get a generation that's farther along, they would not even remember the Egyptian plagues. They wouldn't even have seen all of the things in the wilderness. They would have seen some of the early military campaigns, possibly. But then, where are God's wonderful works? You see, a generation arose that did not know the Lord nor the mighty work that he had done for Israel. Now, what does that mean? It is possible to know something about God without knowing the Lord himself. That's a tragedy in many places. And also, it's clear the parents were not clearly teaching their children about their immediate history, the mighty work that God had done. And so what happened? God wanted his people to continue to do exploits through his power to conquer these nations that were left. They refused to do that. And so the children did not see any conquest that they would have seen if the parents had been willing to really step out in faith and do what God told them in the first place. You see, the next generation, verse 10, did not know God. You know, if you refuse as parents to drive the Canaanites out of your life, what happens to the Canaanites in the Israel sense? Those Canaanites were multiplying in the hills and in their little secluded valleys. And that meant that their children faced a stronger enemy than the parents did. You see, if you do not drive out the Canaanites in your life, then you're going to have difficulty rooting the Canaanites out of your child's life. You want to help your child be more holy than you were when you were at his age. And so to do that, that will only work if you are routing the Canaanites out of your own life. So what does this mean? I believe it means involve the next generation in God's work or lose them. In fact, failure to root out the Canaanites may not necessarily be a matter of salvation in our own lives, but it may create a situation that predisposes our children to actually become Canaanite in their mentality. You see, the failure to fully occupy the land was a demonstration of their worldly mindset. Now, when you think about it, here are these Israelites, they're in the land, they've got the most of the territory, and so not driving those out, you wouldn't see a huge change in their immediate lifestyle, would you? Not likely. They're just living like they want to live. But it really becomes obvious in the next generation as they follow the Canaanites that their parents refused to drive out. And then the next generation does what? It intermarries with those Canaanites. So in the book of Judges, we see the precedent was really set. Because the people did not fully obey God. It's so easy to think, if we obey God partly, God will be pretty pleased. He'll be impressed. That's good enough. You know, maybe sometimes people get the idea from grading in school. Well, anything above 70 is passing. So God ought to be happy. I got an 80. The fact of the matter is, God says, obey me in everything. Love me with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Have me as your king. You see, Jesus is to be our king. I was talking to a professor who taught in a college in North Carolina. He said to me, Ray, in your travels, what do you think the biggest problem is in the churches? I said, the biggest problem is that in most churches, Jesus is not the head. He said, I agree with that. That's what I wrote my PhD thesis on. You know, I was very surprised at his answer. But so many times, churches simply want to say, let's figure out what kind of church we'd like, and let's make one like that. Instead of saying, oh, Jesus is the head of the church. He's the unseen king. He's the one we pay allegiance to. It is not that we have wonderful opinions. If we can just gather people together and get their opinions together, then that'll be right. Let's find out what kind of church Jesus wants. Now, do you see the relevance of the book of Judges? Are we willing to say we want all of what God says? Or do we think, well, if we get 80% of it, that's pretty good. God will be pretty happy with that. The book of Judges is a picture book that shows what happens when we are happy with partial obedience. When we are happy to only obey God partly. Then you see the first part, the first couple generations there, they didn't turn to other gods yet. It says they served the Lord during those days. But after those generations passed off the scene, what happened? Then they started serving these other gods. So this book is a gigantic warning lesson. Now for next time, we're going to look at the story of Gideon. So please do not just say, oh, well, I've heard that story ever since I was a little child. Go home and read the story of Gideon. And it's very likely that we'll take two sessions to deal with it. Story of Gideon. What should we be learning from the story of Gideon? There's lots in there for us to learn. God wrote this down so that thousands of years later, we can profit from things that Gideon did right and from things that Gideon did wrong. You know, one of the great advantages of the Bible is you can learn things the easy way. Have you ever heard people say, experience is the best teacher, but it's a hard master? Is that familiar to you? You've not heard that here in Texas, huh? Well, I've heard that statement. And it's a very bad statement, because in many, many ways, experience is not the best teacher. You know, if you want to build a house, it's not the best teacher to say, well, let's get started. Let's see. They start with cinder blocks, so we're going to lay some cinder blocks right here on the sod, and we'll put a wooden plate on top of that, and we'll build the house. We'll go fast. And then 2 years later, you find that the house is sagging in a funny way because you didn't put in any foundation. Experience isn't the best teacher. You could have talked to somebody who knows what they're doing, and they'd say, build a footing first. Or you could go to Lowe's or Home Depot and get a book, and it'll tell you, put the footing in first. You don't have to learn it by experience. You know, the Bible is so wonderful because there's plenty of things that you don't have to learn by experience. You don't have to learn by experience how bad adultery is. You can read about it in the Bible. You don't have to learn by experience how terrible it is to murder somebody. You can read about it in the Bible. And so we have the privilege of reading the book of Judges, where they refuse to have God as king. See, that's really the root of the problem here. In fact, you'll find in the book of Judges, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Now, who was the king in Israel? It was God, the heavenly king. But they were not living like God was the heavenly king during the Judges period. And so they were living where everyone did what they felt like. This is a picture book that is helping us see how ugly that is. So that means that we in this Christian era need to be able to look at the book of Judges and see how bad it is to disregard God as king. So for tomorrow, study the book of Judges.